Okie dokie, let's do it. So, let's again set our stage, figure out where we are as we sort of have the clock winding down on conceptual foundations. We have already talked about the grand frameworks, and we're in the section of the class now where we're talking about theories that were created by bioethics, or not just theories, but frameworks or methods. We're in the part of the course where moral philosophy does not speak in any credible way. This is all bioethics and the conceptual framework that informs bioethical method, analysis, conversation, dialogue in the field. And we have just today on narrative, and then we have the discussion next time, which will not be, we're all remembering, not be next week. Because next week, I know you don't feel sorry for me, I'm going to Paris, which I don't want to do, but I have to go because it's a big conference in bioethics education, and Penn Bioethics Education, as you well know, because that's why you're here, is at the top of the pecking order, so I couldn't possibly not go, and so I must go, and so even though I'm not going to get out of the hotel, and I'm going to rush right back, got to go. So I am gone all next week, and I don't know what my little French hotel's email possibilities are going to be, so I wouldn't try to email him. But when we get back, then we're going to talk about principalism. And as you know, principalism is pretty much the place where conceptual analysis and bioethics begins. I've put it at the end because at its best, it's deontology. And we've already done that. But at its worst, in the way that it's been bastardizing the field, it becomes a very constrained tool, something I call the principalist paradigm rather than principalism. And it has all of the vices attached to it that Todd Chambers in our session today is going to begin to bring into relief. So it should not surprise you that then this week and the next session are going to be very integrally connected, so much so that the paper we're going to look at, which is called Why the Clinical Ethics We Teach Fails Patients, a piece I wrote for Academic Medicine, is going to use the very case that I'm going to hand up tonight, the very case that we're going to analyze casuistically with the insights that Todd Chambers gives us through the fiction of bioethics. And next week, I'll look at the way in which this case, as it was understood, as it was practiced, as it occurred, didn't it fail to see all of the deliberative presumptions, let's use Herman's language, that were at play, and that mistake, the mistake, in my view, of this very limited moral lens, which is the same shtick that casuistry has, it's the same shtick of tonight's talk from discussion from Todd Chambers, that very limited lens that principalist paradigm put onto that case, I think actually cost this man's death. And so when we look at this case today, we will be looking at it from the perspective of Todd Chambers' work. When we look at it next week, we'll look at the way in which this kind of case is typically analyzed in bioethics through principalism, not through the fault, not the fault of Beecham and Childress, but the way in which principalism has been understood in the field. And we're going to see if we can vow and endeavor to expand the moral lens that we look at when we encounter ethical dilemmas in bioethics, and that's how we'll wrap up. And I'll be sad to see it go, because this is my absolute favorite class, but there you go. All right, so that's the stage setting. Let me talk a little bit about the outline and where we're going. We are going to talk about a book that really took bioethics by storm when it came out, a book by a former president of the American Society of Bioethics and Humanities, one of my friends, Todd Chambers. He is the director now of the Northwestern Center, which is a wonderful center that has both bioethics and a very strong presence of medical humanities, a really wonderful shop. When this book came out, AJOB was in its very first season, the American Journal of Bioethics, which is one of the top, they'll say to you, it's the absolute top journal in the field. Fine, if you're listening, David Magnuson, Glenn McGee, but certainly it's in the top three. So Hastings Center, Kennedy Institute, and AJOB are the top three, no matter what, in some pecking order, who knows. The very first issue of AJOB came out right after this book, The Fiction of Bioethics, and the piece that you read was one of the big launching articles that launched not just Todd Chambers' career, because it was a synopsis of this very important book, but it launched the American Journal of Bioethics as well in 2001. First issue, first volume. All right, so you're reading the synopsis, but actually the rest of the book is kind of like the way that a lot of, and Lance Wehler will agree with me on this, as the way that a lot of theoretically infused English
kind of works do. You get your big, meaty first chapter theory, and then you get a whole bunch of application by this text and this text and this text and this text. Now, if you think about something like queer theory, that's the format of every book in the English subset queer theory that you've ever seen. First set, very heavy theory, and the rest of the book looking at Henry James, Portrait of a Lady, and the next book, Oscar Wilde's this and that, or whatever. And that's what the fiction of bioethics is like, too. So though you've only read a synopsis, you've read the guts. And today we'll be talking, we're mostly interested in the theory, the guts. So you could read the book, and it'll give you the laying out through various pieces and analysis. Well worth reading, but don't feel that you got cheated. You really have the meat of his argument here. All right, we're going to talk about a bioethicist like Todd Chambers, who perceives himself, there's a cadre of people who are in this camp, as outsiders to the practice of bioethics, looking in. People like Renee Fox, if you know, one of our great emeritus professors, will be giving the colloquium in April in part of Arts History of Bioethics class. She's the person who wrote the first book on transplantation. She's 84. She's lovely. You'll love her. It's really funny. When I was planning the colloquium last year in May, she said, "Autumn, I don't know. If you want to have me, wait till April. I'm 84. But she is alive and well and still very productive. And she'll be here with Norm Faust, who's just a few years baby to her. And they are part of this founding community of bioethicists. But the difference is Renee Fox, like Todd Chambers, like Chuck Bosk, our very own sociology of medicine sociologist, they stand outside the room of bioethics and they look in. Todd is one of those people. So he's reflecting on the practice of bioethics, the practice of bioethicists. So that's one of the things we'll talk about. Then I'm going to take you through the social construction of knowledge, shtick, to get us prepared for the discussion we're going to have about genre. We're going to think about the term fiction of bioethics. Why does he call it that? What is he really saying when he says that? And then we're going to walk through the constraints of the genre of bioethics and look at the very interesting features of the genre of bioethics that he claims we operate under. I think he's right, and we're going to think about case analysis given the way in which bioethics is done. I don't expect you to grasp all of that yet, but that's what our plan is as we move forward today. All right, so let's go. First, this outsider point. Many people who do conceptual foundations, like the casuists, people who write theory, write it from the inside. They are practitioners. They are clinical ethicists. They are people who do research ethics. They're not commentators on the field. Todd intends for himself to be a commentator on a discipline, on a domain, not a practitioner. So Todd's not a clinical ethicist. He's someone who looks at the practice from the eye of distance, from a place of, I'm not going to say objectivity because that would thwart the whole point of the fiction of bioethics, but from a place of not being invested in the actual practice of bioethics, but standing outside with a little bit less. It not being a stakeholder, let's put it like that. So when you think about his position on bioethics, think about it, both its pro and con, from the fact of this writer coming from the outside, so the fact that he's the director of the Bioethics Institute, he really doesn't see himself as a bioethicist, and he would not define himself that way. Now, what exactly is the practice that we're talking about? Is it the practice of going to conferences? Is it the practice of commenting on the pharmaceutical industry? Is it the practice of teaching? No, it's one practice. The entire discussion today is going to be about one practice. The practice of writing up, of constructing cases. You're welcome to cough. Just go right in and cough. Cough, cough, cough. I don't care. I know. You can't stifle it. You should just go for it.
I need some water, no?
Yeah. Cough, cough, cough. You'll be okay.
My diet,
it's like, I know exactly. You'll be all right. But you're not interrupting us, so just call.
I guess I am.
No, you're not. Not at all. I can get us right back into the sentence. The thing we're talking about, the practice we're talking about is clinical ethics cases. We're talking about the way in which, when we write, when we think about clinical ethics. Here. Jazz?
Yeah.
All right.
I'm just annoying. I don't know.
I don't think so. And I am clinically trained. All right. This is what we're talking about. Clinical ethics cases. Because much of bioethics surrounds the case. Right? You think about papers that are written in bioethics. Think about my piece on casuistry last week. The conversation piece, the object in the middle of the room, is the case. And that doesn't have to be the way that a field practices itself, but that's the way that bioethics practices. It organizes its reflections around a case. And it's case construction that is Todd Chambers' target here. And I'm using the word case construction very literally here. I am talking about the way, and Todd is talking about the way, in which we write cases. We formulate cases. We think about cases. Because his contention is going to be that the very way we write cases, the genre of case construction, already determines, precludes, restrains, envelops, invites certain ethical analysis. The writing itself, the formulation itself, of the clinic, and I'm going to speak now specifically about the clinical ethics case, though it's also true about the animal biotechnology case or the research ethics case, but we're going to talk entirely tonight about clinical ethics, the way in which the case is written, what's in it and what's not in it, the structure of it already determines the range of things we can say about it. It doesn't determine one thing we can say. It determines the range. And if it determines the range of what can be said, it also determines what can't be said, and not only what can't be said, what can't be seen. And it's from that profound point that I think he's spot on, that is the reason why this book took off and had such impact in the field, and I think he's exactly right on it. Now, to make this case, I need to talk to you a little bit, for a minute, about social constructionism as a philosophical commitment, as a social science theory or philosophical theory of the way in which human beings go about their lives and the way in which they interpret the world that they're in. Social constructionism was a movement that had its heyday in the 80s. It got a little extreme, and if you have encountered social construction, like the book The Social Construction of Reality, which is one of its most famous books, you might feel like, oh, you roll your eyes. If you hear one more thing about the social construction of reality, it's going to poke your eye out, because it went too far. It went really far. And it didn't really make these kind of claims, but it looked like it was on the hairy edge of making claims like, if Autumn keeps walking from where she is now, the fact that she will think that she's hitting a table is just the construction in her mind that there's a table here. And so you go like this, and you say, well, wait a minute. That really didn't feel mental to me. Like, that really feels like, wait, there's a table here. So social construction, if it's going to say something that crazy, is not worth thinking about. And the thing I used to say when I was a student in the 80s, the very late 80s, of course, so I was a child, but in the 80s, I used to say, well, no, wait a minute. Airplanes fly. I mean, get in one, I hope, on Saturday to Paris, and they actually fly. So there's only so much social construction. It's, you know, things could be otherwise. The way that we interpret the world is the way that the world is. We could interpret the world other ways, sure. But there's going to have to be constraints on that problem. Like, we have physics, and maybe we could look at physics and explain it another way, but basically the way we explain it has airplanes flying. And sure, we could explain biological processes and disease in different ways, but the truth is that when I have a bacteria and you give me penicillin, it shoots down that bacteria and I seem to do better. So there are certain kinds of constraints about the physical world that we're in that seem to put parameters on how far we can go with this idea of social construction, but here's its gem. Here's its kernel, I think, of genius. It says, our interpretations of the world could largely be otherwise. We could say different things about the world than we do. We carve up the world in certain ways. But that's an artifact of our culture, our history, the conversations we have, the conversations we don't have, the ways in which we have organized learning. There's all kinds of reasons why we come to interpret things the way that we do. Like, for example, is there any reason why a person who's wearing something like this that doesn't have any legs, that starts with a waistband here and goes out like that and comes down here, is there any reason why we have to call that a skirt and that we have to think a skirt is something a girl would wear? No, because after all, in Scotland, the people who are wearing these things, kilts, aren't actually girls, or at least plenty of them aren't. So the fact that here, skirt means girl, or people trying to, you know, inhabit the feminine in look, that's an artifact of the culture we're in. Could it be otherwise? Of course it could be otherwise. Yes, it could be otherwise. We cover up certain parts of our body. Do we have to cover them up? Obviously no, because in other parts of the world, people cover up this and not that. That's all social construction. And to me, how could you refute it? I mean, there are lots of choices that we have made in the world that are an artifact. For example, think about glasses. Is this the only way they could fit on our head? No, we could have other constructions to put lenses in front of ourselves so that we could see clearly, but this is the way that we do it and we call these glasses. It's in that spirit that social constructionism seems to me to be spot on. And when we think the world that we've got is the only way it could be, we are naive. It's that insight that Todd Chambers brings to clinical ethics, to bioethics. We think that the only way that we could do clinical ethics, and I don't mean literally say, this is the only way we could do it. I mean, we operate as if the only way we could ever do bioethics is the way that we do it. That it's our practice, for example, of having cases, of writing them up the way we do, was a choice that we made from the objective bird's eye, God's eye, objective place of, this is the best possible thing we could do. But what Todd wants to do is say, no, we weren't nearly as objective as we would like to make ourselves seem when we wrote cases, when we decided to construct cases the way that we did. And when I say we decided, I don't know who the first, you know, I can list a bunch of the founding fathers and mothers of bioethics and who they were, but basically, in dialogue, it came to be the case that human beings made decisions, actually made determinations about how bioethics material was going to look. And that decision has ramifications and reverberations and implications for the way in which we are forced to practice bioethics. And yes, it could have been otherwise. So that's the first move that he makes from this social construction commitment. His basic commitment philosophically is of social construction. It could have been otherwise. We, the people who founded the field, we selected a mode and a practice. And that decision could have been different. And that decision, just like all of the other decisions we have made about many, many things, many artifacts, many cultural practices, many professional practices, has implications for what gets done, what can be done, what cannot be done. I'm going to stop here to see if you have any questions as I transition us to this idea of the fiction of bioethics. Any questions on social construction? What's the relevance? Why is Autumn talking about it? How far does it go? What's its basic punchline? Are you all set with that? The basic line is, it could have been otherwise. Human beings made choices, and those choices then made a practice reified, practically like it was already there written in the physics or the cosmos. And that is not true. Okay? That leads us to the fiction of bioethics. And I'm going to ask you this question. Why, either because you read it in the Todd Chambers piece or based on what I've now introduced, why would Todd Chambers, who stands outside this room, the image I'm using is that the room is the domain of bioethics, the bioethicist, the practice of bioethics. Todd stands outside that room at the door and peers in on our practice. Why does he say of us, it's the fiction of bioethics? Why is he talking about the fiction of bioethics? There's two meanings that he has for this accusation about bioethics being a fiction. What do you think?
We made it up.
All right. So in one sense, it's that we actually made up the field. That's true. what do we think about the way in which we practice bioethics? The case.
It's objective.
We think it's objective. Exactly. So one of the fictions, one of the senses of, there's two senses in this book, one of the senses of the fiction of bioethics is we tell ourselves a fiction, a story, when we tell ourselves that bioethics, specifically clinical ethics case construction, is objective. We tell ourselves a story. Now, in some ways, if I say to my kids, okay, that's a fiction, I mean that's a lie, that's an untruth. And he doesn't want to saddle us quite that heavily. No, he doesn't want to quite sanction us like that, except if we get too big for our own britches and we think, oh, no, 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 the way we do it, that's objective. Then he does want to say, no, you tell yourself that. You led yourself to believe that this was objective when, in fact, you made subjective choices. What do I mean by that? Choices of human beings for other human beings. They were made by subjects. They are not inherited in the way that, apparently, if I do keep walking here, I will get black and blue marks right here on my leg. I mean, there is something, if there is anything in the world that is objective, that fact, that seems to be fact. Bioethics tells itself a fiction that my running into this table is the same thing as how cases had to be written. They are just objective. It's the way it should be done. That's how it ought to go. We tell ourselves bioethics is an objective practice, couldn't have been otherwise, when in fact it could be. But what's the other sense of the fiction of bioethics? So one sense is we tell ourselves a fiction. There's another sense, and it means, and it's in this sense of, it's what we're looking at is the fiction of bioethics. What we're studying now, today, for the rest of the day, is the fiction of bioethics. Why is he saying that? What is he saying it about?
If I understood him right, it's the way we tell our story that influences the outcome of the story.
Okay. And I'm only going to focus on one thing you said. What he means by fiction of bioethics in the second sense is what we're doing is storytelling. Just like fiction that you read on the bestseller list, that you tell your kids or your grandchildren, you know, stories tonight, those are stories. The fiction of bioethics in the second sense is the stories of bioethics. You could just substitute it in. I'm going to hold this up. This is the case we're going to look at tonight. And I'm going to give it to you in a few minutes. And I don't want you to take it out. Don't take it out. Turn it over. And I'll tell you why. Because I don't want you to read the top and the bottom at the same time. You probably have, and that's my mistake. I should really tell myself to get that thing off Blackboard. But what I want to do as an exercise is focus on the case, which I'll hand out in a few minutes. But what he wants us to understand is this thing, which doesn't really look like it's all that, like whodunit, you know, fiction in the sense of bestseller list, or my daughter's reading this book, The Lucky One. I had to stop and think, this is not my genre, but supposedly this movie, whatever. She's 10, and she's on chapter 11. She started this morning, she's on chapter 11. That's how engaged she is in whatever this Lucky One book is that I bought her yesterday. Well, this doesn't seem quite like it's going to be that captivating, so why call it the fiction of bioethics, the story of bioethics, for the exact reason that you just said? Because the construction of this tale isn't any different in certain fundamentals as Nicholas Sparks, it's come to me, Nicholas Sparks' creation of The Lucky One. It's the same mechanism. This is a story. So he means fiction of bioethics in the sense that this is a story. And what that's going to do is rub a lot of people the wrong way, because they're going to say, this is not made up. This is a true case. These are facts. This is about a real person. Whereas, my guess is, the Lucky One guy, Zac Efron, see, it's coming to me if I just think hard enough about it. It's not, that book is written, the movie's not about a real person. It's made up. And this, says the defender of the bioethics case, is not made up. This is truth. Because, in fact, and this is true, there was a man in a MICU somewhere that this was written about. There was a man, and that man is dead. And that's all true. So in the sense of, and maybe you think The Lucky One, you know, is not the best thing. Let's take something like The Lorax. I mean, I'm pretty sure that was made up, right? Okay, so if I say, this is a fiction, and The Lorax is a fiction, you can start to chafe, because you feel like, really, what about the real doctors who were in this story? What about the real man who was in this story? But what we want to do today is uncover, why does Todd say, this is also a story? And it is nothing more than a story, and needs to be understood as a story. And we're going to try to figure out what are the implications of refiguring, reframing what we have in front of us, not as something that is just a mirror of the world that we're in, but is actually a subjective tale about something that occurred. This is not nonfiction, and we think it is. Questions? I saw him.
Is the latter part, does he consider the patient's story fiction?
He's going to consider any rendition to be a story in the sense, and that's what we're going to look at with all the genres, in the sense that it comes from the human subject. And so it is subjective. So it does not mean that there's something untrue about this case, just as he would not accuse the patient telling her story that what she's saying is untrue. But what he is going to say is, it is told from the vantage point of one particular human being, just as this has been told from the vantage point of one particular human being. And one of the things we're going to have to end up thinking about at the end of this session and at the end of next is, if what he says is true about the way in which the stories, either this one or its counter on the bottom, which you, I hope you haven't, you know, you don't, we're not going to look at yet, those are two different stories. If there are two stories, or four stories, or 20 stories, what does it mean for clinical ethics and for bioethicists who are trying to help navigate through what is obviously a clear conundrum? There is a problem here. If there's just all kinds of stories, does that leave us in a place of, well, might as well just go home? No. If you want the punchline is going to be, you got to get all these stories together, and you got to mediate through those stories. You have to have each person with his story coming together, protecting her own story, her own worldview, so that while Todd doesn't take his work to the stage where he then says, what we need is bioethics mediation, he's very much simpatico with my taking his book to the next conclusion, which is what we need in clinical ethics is bioethics mediation, so that this story is out in the converse, is in the dialogue, and this story is in the dialogue. So I'm not going to leave us high and dry. Okay, we'll throw up our hands. I'm going to say, no, we have a way of navigating through the fact that we come with subjective stories, and that is to mediate those conflicts by having stakeholders, that is, authors of their own story, come and tell those stories together and work together to find a single narrative thread that can unify those stories and give us a path forward. That is going to be the mediation punchline.
This is story as narrative rather than story as something that's completely made up.
That's right. And we're not going to, for the rest of the day, we're not even going to think about made up. Nobody is trying to make up anything. But that doesn't detract from the fact that it is a tale, because it's a tale told by a person. It is a product of a person. So his accusation about how things that we write are fictions, he would extend even to, like, lab reports. Because what he'll say is not that any scientist made up the content of the lab report, but that the way in which lab reports are done, or the way in which pieces in nature or cell are constructed, could have been otherwise. That there are genres, and those genres themselves are artifacts of choices human beings made. And we could have done it differently. In fact, have you seen medical articles from about 100, 150 years ago? Mm-hmm. They look very, very different. Now, sometimes it's because they're all kooky in what they're saying. But sometimes they're actually on the money. Sometimes they actually have the same view that we have about what's happening biologically. Even so, they look kinky. They look like, yikes, did you get your genre confused? They look like they have confused the professional and appropriate way to convey medical information. They look down with the people, all history infused, and they've got narrative going on. And That's right, because at the time, the convention was different. So even if you can see that they are saying the same thing medically, they're not saying it the same way, it's in that story that Todd is talking about genre and story. Not as if anyone is trying to pull the wool over anybody's eyes, not that anyone is acting falsely, not that anyone is acting without integrity. That's all assumed. Everyone already is. But now, we're going to look and see what is the genre of this, because there is a very particular genre. Questions and thoughts in this preliminary moment?
Just one thought. The Japanese movie Rashomon is a very good example.
Okay, I don't know this.
To incorporate a video element to take home. There's this movie Rashomon made some time ago. I'm not sure if you're aware. But it's basically the same story, a particularly horrifying story that's told from the perspective of everyone who participates.
Oh, there you go.
So you see the movie six times over.
Oh, great. That's the same. It's the same shtick. Absolutely it is, yeah. All right, so we've talked about fiction bioethics in two senses, and now we're going to look at genre, because the currency here for the analysis today from narrative theory is genre. When we think about genres, we can get a whole list of various forms that the written word can take. Give me some examples. And let's think inside the box and outside the box. In other words, the first thing that, and I know now you're trying to think creatively, but when I just said that, give me genres you know. Just spit them out, quick. Don't try to think too hard. What do you get?
Science fiction.
Science fiction.
Drama.
Comedy. Romance, right. Good. The poetry. First, poetry, right? The first move out of the starting gate is to discuss, and that's right, everything you said is right, the kind of genres that you would study in a department called English. Or at least English in the old days when my dad got his PhD in English. Now, who knows what English is? I remember meeting Lance and looking at his work and thinking, I don't understand why this is English. These are films, for heaven's sake. It's not even a book. You know, obviously English has taken a very new turn in what kind of text it deals with. But what you gave me are the classic genres of literature. Writing. I mean, what can I say? It's already, but let's say literature. Now I want you to think, though, about other kinds of genres. What is a genre? It is a practice with certain types of constraints, conventions, dimensions, where if you violate it in that writing, when you are known and understood to be trying to exist inside a genre, you will ruffle feathers, or you will be dismissed, or you'll look like a kook. I want you to give me some genres that fit that, you know, other genres, not just poetry, romance, comedy. And I'm telling you, let me tell you why we need to think out of the box here. Because those genres have already had enough leeway that they've started to mix things up about a bit. So you can have authors mixing genres so that you could have a comedy and a romance. You could have a comedy and a mystery novel. So people in the world of literature have already mixed genres. But I want you to give me some genres that have very strict parameters still. Give me some genres that are, and all genres in a certain sense do have parameters. Let me not make the point too loosey-goosey. Let me give you an example. Let's talk about the mystery novel. You can probably have a funny mystery novel. I would think, I don't do a lot of reading, but I would imagine some are kind of funny, right? And sometimes they can be tragic. So you can mix in that way. But here's one thing you have to have in a mystery novel. Give it to me.
Mystery. Right.
Something's got to happen. So imagine that the mystery novel is Autumn going home tonight. And here's the mystery novel. She gets in her car. She travels down Route 95. She arrives at home and kisses her children. End of story. Now that would really be a problem in the genre of mystery, right? Because there's nothing mysterious about it. Right. Okay. So what I want you to do now is give me genres with tight parameters that are not in the field that you would, not what you'd study over there at that Fisher Bennett Hall.
Sci-fi.
The name. What is it?
Sci-fi.
Yeah, sci-fi is in Fisher Bennett Hall. That's the English department. I want you to think out of the box of that.
Journalism?
Okay. Give me some conventions around journalism.
It has to be, or you have to fact check.
All right. Okay.
It's within a certain time, usually like hard news, it's maybe current events.
All right. So if you if you're talking about there was this event and the church decided to go out and start burning up people and places and making a big fuss because people didn't agree with them, and we called it the Inquisition, we would not call that journalism, because it's not contemporary. We might use it as a foil to talk about something that would be Inquisition-like, but if the whole thing was about the Inquisition, we couldn't exactly call it journalism, because it's like, that's not news, right? So it has to be news. Good. What else? Come, a couple of other things.
In journalism?
Yeah.
Objectivity.
All right, so you're trying to be objective. So if your whole write-up was, and I looked at this and I said to myself, I just really do not like what's happening here. I mean, I see a burning building and I see a whole bunch of, you know, people. And then my opinion is this really should not have happened. And what would that be called?
A blog entry.
Would be a blog entry, a bad one, an op-ed, an editorial. But it wouldn't be called journalism. Okay, you're catching on. Let's move away from journalism. So there are very clear constraints. And if you can move a little bit. Like you can have the opening anecdote. Right? A lot of people have the opening anecdote. You sent me a piece, which was journalism, about physicians deciding not to take aggressive care and instead deciding to do palliative care. It starts with Dr. Bob. Dr. Bob has a late-stage melanoma, but he is talking with his wife. It's an anecdote. But then it moves to this, you know, rendition of what do doctors decide and on. Okay, good. Give me some other genres.
Research protocols.
Okay. Great. The research protocol, the R01 application. So here you are in your R01. So for the NIH, you're writing up your research proposal. You want to get grant funding. I'm not going to belabor this point. It's important just to get a little feel for it. So, and then in the middle, you say, the cat in the hat sat on the mat, and you start doing some kind of rhyme in the middle of it. No, can't do it. So whenever you genre offend, you're already out of the game. Can't offend in the genre. Good. Give me another one. One more. I'll give you one because we got a lot of these people in the room. The legal brief. A lot of lawyers and law students in here. Give me a texture of the legal brief. We got at least 5-6 people in here who can answer this very expertly. What is the tone of that?
Very formal.
Yeah, like give it to me. Give me a sentence. Come on. In re.
Well, the first thing that came to mind, not necessarily the sense, just the citation formats.
That's true. Not so fun. Give me a legal opinion instead of a legal brief. How does it start?
Herewith, hereby, etc. But they're really moving away from that. There's a lot of plain English in it now.
Plain English, but certain kinds of English.
Yes.
Right? I mean, I think, I'm sure that you all feel now that it's getting real loosey-goosey. I got to tell you. What was the last legal brief I read? Oh, I know. Okay, I'm going to give you an example, because this will build on our theme here, and then we'll transition. When you're not familiar with the constraints of the genre, when you're not schooled inside the genre itself can actually make the, and this will be a nice segue, will actually make the content opaque to the reader, and I'm going to give you an example. There was a case where a clinical ethicist was sued for not asking all family members what they all wanted done with a loved one. That's the basic shtick of the case. And I wanted to write an ethics commentary about it. So I got up the actual case. It's not decided yet, but it's just the plaintiff against the whoever the other person is and all this. And I actually couldn't figure out what was happening. The legalese in there about the way that they talk, and obviously you guys are not helping me out here. If I could replicate it, I could have understood it in the first place. But I could not decipher it. I couldn't figure out who was who, the way that they referred to the various participants. I couldn't catch the story. I couldn't catch it. That clearly shows constraints of genre and who gets to be included in it and who's excluded from it. So genre conventions actually go another step. And they lock certain people out of the dialogue. And we're going to see that a lot tonight. Any other comments on this? Go ahead.
I would just say that I think professions, various things, many of them have languages. So some of the words aren't familiar, as in philosophy. Some of the words aren't familiar. So some of that claim to counterclaim that you might come up against may just be words, in addition to legalese, which there is. But sometimes there's languages of things that keep people out.
Absolutely. But that's all part of genre. Because, for example, when you start a philosophy paper, you are going to speak in a certain kind of language, but you're also going to introduce the paper in certain kinds of ways with certain vocabulary. But that all plays into the constraints and the conventions of the genre. So it's a very important point and all part of that same conundrum. All right. Now, the point about genre is that it could have been otherwise. So it could have been the case that somebody at some point decreed no legal document should ever be published until a layperson has... I'm not suggesting that this is a good idea. I'm saying it could have been until a layperson had actually looked at it to make law and what affects the people accessible by the people. I don't know if that's a good idea or not, but they could have done it. And if they had done it, it would look very differently. As to medical journals. Medical journals use a lot of what language? A lot of the terminology is Latin. Exactly. And Latin isn't a language that is actually taught much anymore and is certainly only taught in the highfalutin places, and so you can't actually access what these terms are. So for every lay kind of term that the people might know, and got plenty of clinicians in here, and maybe you can give us one of these. But there is a regular English word, but there's also a word that would be Latinate. Can you give us an example of one?
Elevated heart rate is tachycardia.
There you go, perfect. Elevated heart rate. We could just have a stipulation in medical journals, no more tachycardia. Because the truth about tachycardia is it doesn't give us any more than elevated heart rate. It's just a word that is part of a convention, is a gatekeeping. Okay, we're ready now to start our worry here about bioethics. Now, I want you to take the case, and I want you to fold it, and of course, I made this mistake last year too, so it is true that you cannot teach an old dog a new trick. Take this and fold it in half, and don't look at the bottom. And if you have already looked at the bottom, forget that you actually saw the bottom. All right, very good. Now, I inherited this case. This is a case that is used in the fourth year medical school class, year in, year out. I've been teaching that medical school bioethics class since 2002. They use it every time. It's the kickoff case. That's because it's a case that happened near and dear. So it is, I'm not saying it's a Hupp case or a Pensy case or a Presby case or a Bryn Mawr case, but it's a case that was known by the person who wrote it. And this is the way that it's written, and this is the way that it's used all the time. Now, what I want to say about this case is, this is exactly what every case looks like. So I want somebody's going to, this is what bioethics cases look like. This is a perfect illustration of the genre. So I would like somebody to read this, and let's have it be a clinician. So Roxanne, why don't you give this a try?
A 30-year-old man was admitted from the ED to the MICU for upper GI bleeding. Stat endoscopy revealed a large posterior duodenal ulcer as the likely source. Although he wasn't actively bleeding at the time of the endoscopy, he started to re-bleed during the night. The patient agreed to get blood transfusions and signed the hospital's consent form. He received 2 units of packed red cells, which raised his hemoglobin 2 grams per deciliter. He had only 2 peripheral catheters, a 22 and 20 gauge, for IV access. Despite multiple attempts, the MICU health staff couldn't place a larger IV angiocath peripherally.
Okay, let's stop right there. We are 7 lines into the case. Fredo, what's the bioethical term? You might distill it, but did you see it yet? What have you noticed so far about these 7 lines? What is the topic sentence? What is the subject matter? What's the stuff that we understand? What do we have? You could distill. I don't want you to use your imagination to distill. What did we just get conveyed to us? All medicine. It's all medicine. Right. Now, you might say, oh, it has to be that way. Well, then maybe it does and maybe it doesn't, because what we're not going to do right yet is criticize the genre. We're going to illuminate the genre. Go ahead.
Just to understand the profiling of this, this was written up to be a bioethics case?
Yeah. Okay. This is a bioethics case,
okay.
And they all look like this. They all look like this. If you go to the Hupp Ethics Committee, and right now, they let me skip today. I've been so crazy busy, but they were doing a case presentation. If they had done a case presentation, this is what it would look like. This is exactly how it would sound. This would be the language. This is what bioethics looks like. All right, go ahead and read the rest of it for us, just so we have the full thing in our view, and then we're going to do an analysis of what we saw here.
So the angiocath perfectly. The resident explained to the patient the need for a central venous catheter, its risks and benefits. The patient was upset at the failed attempts to place the large peripheral IV and lacked confidence in the host staff to place a central line. He refused to give consent for the central venous catheter. Later that night, the patient's blood pressure suddenly dropped. He rapidly lost consciousness and then his rhythm. Despite the ICU resident placing a femoral catheter stat, he could not be resuscitated due to the ongoing large GI hemorrhage.
Yeah. All right. Talk to me about this genre. Tell me about its conventions, its constraints, its elements, what's here, what's not here. Tell me what kind of a genre we've got here.
Straight up physician's report to me, personally, by the definition, it's cringe-inducing just to read it, because it describes in fairly, I think, graphic terms as to what's happening on the outside. It's entirely external. I have no idea what else is going on with anyone else there, including the patient. So that's just the first reaction.
Okay, Shelley?
I don't think they've identified what the problem was. So if you read this, you don't know why this is coming to the ethics committee.
Okay. Besides the he refused and didn't give consent, so
but,
you know it's about consent. Right. I agree.
Okay, so and they didn't give consent and they didn't follow. They listened to that, so what's the issue here?
Right. Exactly. It's going to be the central question here, that it already looks like they believe the writer, the authors, have already defined the problem. But in fact, they've assumed that there's a certain kind of problem. But they could identify different kinds of problems. They identified one. Consent was not given for what the clinicians assessed would be life-sustaining. That's the problem. They defined one problem. There might have been 10 other problems. And that problem is considered to be obvious. Now let me take a little PS here and just, or footnote really, and just say there is no criticism of any author here. This is entirely about genre, not about the authors themselves. Because what is the truth about the authors of this case? What do we know? We don't know them. What do we know about them?
They're either physicians or
All right. Okay, that's an important point. But who they are? But tell me about who they are relative to the genre this is. What do we know? If it's true that this is the bioethics case genre, then what can we say about authors who write in this genre?
They're constrained and limited by the genre.
Right? So let's not worry that we're criticizing the authors. They can't break out here into song. Now, what Todd Chambers, or poetry, there is a genre that has been imposed, just like there's a genre that's imposed when you do an amicus brief, and a genre that's imposed when you write a philosophy paper, and a genre that's imposed when you do an op-ed. Now, that doesn't mean we can't, over time, try to help people understand that they're locked into a particular formula, but they are locked into a particular formula. And it is way too much to ask a single author to say, I'm breaking out of the mold here. Well, first of all, at your own peril, right? You can't just break out of a genre. That's the problem with genres. They're not flexible like that. All right. So, tell me, again, you've already said it, what does this look like?
Looks like a medical case.
Looks like a straight-up medical case, exactly. Now, I want you to tell me, what's your hypothesis about why this, which isn't really about medicine, right? Here's another frame. Let's just take what we've got here. Forget the other stories, the patient's stories, the nurse's stories, all kinds of stories we could have. Just take this story. The story could be, imagine that now this is the entire case and I'm giving it to you. In my judgment, I thought that person A should do X. Person A didn't want to do X. I feared when person A didn't do X that it would be to that person's peril. Person A didn't do X. Person A died. That could have been the way the story was told, right? So, and actually, all this femoral, IV, statin, DUSK, VED, basically the ethics, you pretty much get the ethics of this write-up. Not that that's the full ethics. I'm taking Shelley's point seriously. But the ethics we see in the top half, you got, actually, from my rendition of person A and person B and option and X and whatever. In other words, you didn't have to put this medicine in to get to the story that I told, but the story I told would also be a plausible rendition of the ethics. So now I ask you, why is it in this genre? It's in this genre now because this is the genre of bioethics cases. That's not my question. My question is, how did it come to be that this is how clinical ethics had to be done? What do you think? Got an answer?
It gives a sense of objectivity.
Okay.
It allows you to ground yourself in something, a legitimacy.
Okay.
You envision the audience that it's going to be.
Okay. You're seeing lots of different things.
I'm not saying I believe any of that.
I know. We're just hypothesizing here. Let's take any others, and we're going to look at each of them in turn. Go ahead, Shelley.
It seems like a way of avoiding liability, because when I read, if I hadn't read the second part in the reading, I wouldn't necessarily know that perhaps something had gone awry.
All right. I'm going to use the word culpability, and I'll put liability down below it, because I think that even if somebody isn't worried about being sued, which they could be worried about moral culpability. So I'm going to put both down. Other things that you want to put on, and we're going to talk about each one of these.
Just that a lot of people that are concerned with bioethics are clinicians, and that's how they talk.
Okay, so I think that's this one. Let's go through each one, and then we'll see if you want to add anything else. Let's take this one, then we'll go back to the other. Let's talk about the audience. It's an interesting point you've just made, both of you, about, and there are two actually separate points. One is that there is a question of what gives one legitimacy. The other question is the audience there is. In other words, let me step back and see if I can make both of these points, just to show you how I think there really are two elements of this point, and they're both profound. First, your point is the people who are mostly engaged in clinical ethics analysis are providers. They're either nurse providers or they're physician providers. They are clinically trained. They are providers. And so when you're talking among providers, you talk provider talk. That's a hypothesis, and I'm going to thwart it. But I like it. I really like it. Just like Shelley said, well, look, there's a vocabulary of law, and these people who do law, they talk to each other like that because that's the vocabulary of law. So if bioethics is filled with clinicians and people who know medicine, then medicine would be the currency of bioethics. That presupposes that the genre that we have in front of us was created by whom? Who created, if that story's true, then who created the genre? Who crafted this convention? What category?
Clinicians.
Right, exactly. Your story is true if physicians or nurses were the ones who created the genre.
What if you're creating the genre, but you have to sell it to...
Okay, that's different. Point two. Hold. Good. But hang on. Let's go point one first. Point one's hypothesis is, we got to talk the talk, because the people who made this, that's their vocabulary. It's just like if the people who created some dialogue about other minds, or how do I know that I'm dreaming, are philosophers, then you're going to expect thought experiments and drowning children in bathtubs and stuff like that. That's what you're going to expect, because that's the talk they talk. Just like lawyers talk a talk. But that would presuppose that the people who actually created clinical ethics were physicians. Yeah, that's not true. Guess who created clinical ethics? Philosophers and theologians. Physicians came late in the game, relatively speaking. In fact, if you look at Art Kaplan's History of Bioethics class, you're going like this looking for a clinician. Where are the clinicians, right? There's some clinicians hovering here and there, but Dan Brock, you know, Renee Fox, you start listing out the big players of bioethics, none of them are clinicians. It isn't clinicians who created the genre. So the first hypothesis is false.
But who wrote this, though?
Yeah. Okay. Ah, but this is just a convention now. This person was a clinician, no doubt about it, because now there's been a serious shift. So that, for example, if you look at the Fox study from the 2007 about ethics committees and ethics consultations in the United States, it's an incredible 90% of people on ethics committees or who work in clinical ethics are either MDs or nurses. So now what you're saying is true. But the genre is one that this author inherited. This genre wasn't put together by the clinicians. It was put together
by the philosophers
for selling it to the clinicians. Exactly. It's the second hypothesis. Shelley wants to get in behind this.
Prior to bioethics, as it's called, there were always medical ethics and issues of medical ethics. There was a genre before. I mean, bioethics didn't start with issues related to medicine. There's a whole medical ethics field.
Well, there's always been conundrums, like Hippocrates. I'm sure he struggled. But as a genre, as a field, bioethics, and this is what arts class is about, arts class can trace the beginnings. And Art and I actually have a couple of pieces in print where we write the history of bioethics. There's lots of works out of the history of bioethics. But remember that before there was, any time a practice gets coalesced into a profession, there are likely experiences in human history that relate. For example, before there was legal sanction in the penal code, there were probably cave people who were grabbing each other's flints. So human experience is human experience. Were there dilemmas? Of course there were dilemmas. But bioethics, I'm talking about a practice, clinical ethics, can trace itself to a very particular time in American history. And yes, it's American history. Because America, U.S., is what developed the field of bioethics. Not that there weren't medical dilemmas all over the world. There were bioethical dilemmas all over the world. But I'm talking about a particular practice. And I'm not even saying it's good. I could even say if it had been developed in another culture, in another part of the world, in another part of North America, it might be better, and it most certainly would be different. But bioethics is an American institution in its founding, which does not mean that it owns. Let's not get confused. I'm not saying the U.S. owns medical dilemmas. I'm saying that bioethics as a discrete practice started in the United States, and I'm not saying that's a good thing. But I'd like, Shelley, why are you squinting at me?
Because I don't think that that's a true comment. Yeah, I think there's been bioethics developed. I don't know what you mean when you say bioethics, but certainly the Netherlands have been dealing with bioethics and have people that call themselves bioethicists.
Canadians Since when?
Have people that call themselves
Since
bioethicists.
When?
Well, I can tell you Canadian bioethicists go back at least, there was a Canadian Bioethics Society that was founded at least 25 years ago. And that.
But I'm talking 1960, that's 52 years ago.
And they were. I think it's wrong to say, I don't think that's correct historically, so I don't think it's decidedly an American phenomenon.
Okay.
It's different in each jurisdiction, and most jurisdictions put it back 40 or 50 years because they all had seminal cases.
Okay, and so, and what's great is, and I'm, you should take this up with Art in the history of bioethics.
Yeah, and he conceded that it was a North American phenomenon.
Okay, so it's Canadian in the United States. I'll just throw that in so we can move on.
I think it's worldwide, actually. I don't think it's even just North America. But that.
Okay, I mean, so, and if this were the history, we should take that up. But and maybe Americans, you know, it's just the same imperialism that they've all got. But here's the thing. Clinical ethics is done in a certain way. Let's just limit it to the United States because the rest of them doesn't, you know, they can do their clinical ethics any way they want. So let's start with clinical ethics. This institution of the United States got formalized and packaged in a certain way at a certain time in the 70s, especially as it got anchored with that early Quinlan case. Prior to that, there were a couple of cases. It really starts here, at least, right around there. At that time, it was not clinicians who were on the foreground of pushing bioethics. It was the theologians and the philosophers. And they did not pick a philosophical or a theologian or a theo, whatever that word, adjective would be of theology, mode of describing ethics in the institutions where clinical ethics got done. They adopted this particular genre. And why did they adopt this particular genre? I think there's at least a very powerful hypothesis that it's because this genre had currency and legitimacy with the people that were the audience in these dilemmas. And those were the clinicians. I mean, think about, for example, what might speak against writing a case like this? If you think about clinical ethics dilemmas, you think about clinical ethics controversies, what would be the first thing you'd think about writing in this genre in terms of all the various stakeholders? What is true about this genre that seems a little bit odd given all the stakeholders that would be involved in a clinical ethics dilemma? Right, so if given that clinical ethics dilemmas involve patients and families and clergy and who knows what else, this genre already presupposes that they are not important in the dialogue that the genre is engaging. Because if they were, it couldn't be written like this. So it already, by its construction, prioritizes which part of the stakeholders, what the hierarchy actually is. And that's, I think, that amplifies your point about who the audience is. In other words, let's put it like this. Could you not conceive of clinical ethics as being at least as important, if not more important, to patients and their families than to physicians? Because, in an important sense, the physicians, in this case, are going to go home alive and well. But the person who's not potentially going home alive and well is the patient. You can think about many clinical ethics dilemmas that involve patients and families. In some sense, who are the most important players? I don't know, but one possibility might be that the most important players are actually the patients or the families who will be the recipient of the decision, or who will be in who will have their lives altered for this decision. Does that mean that the nurses and the doctors and the clinical ethicists shouldn't be involved? No, don't misunderstand me. I'm simply saying that if the target audience of the dialogue, if the people who were supposed to engage in the dialogue were primarily patient-focused, you wouldn't decide to write it up this way. You couldn't. Why would you? You'd write it up the way I said it, at the very least. Right? You would have a different genre if you expected a different audience. And the audience you're trying to garner legitimacy with is the clinically trained audience. And why would you want that? Why would you want to have an audience? Why would you want to have, why would you need to garner legitimacy with the clinically trained audience?
So they listen.
Right. Because otherwise, what's one of the things that's true about every profession is it's hard to get traction when you're an outsider. So if the people who founded American bioethics were the philosophers and the theologians, they would have to fight for the legitimacy of this new formalization. Again, I'm not arguing there were no dilemmas. I'm arguing that it became formalized as a practice to be thought about with the ethics committees. And ethics committees are not 60, 70, 80 years old in the United States. Once there was this group called clinical ethicists or ethics committees, their work had to have purchase, had to have legitimacy with the people who were already in the institution of medicine. And the people who were in the institution of medicine were nurses and doctors. And they had a particular kind of speech. So the genre on the fiction of bioethics narrative, and I think it's got good traction, had to look a certain way.
Does that fit in with the familiarity? Like, it's hard to get a physician or a nurse to read it and understand what's going on in your clinical ethics case. They throw it out in the way that philosophy normally is written.
For sure, it couldn't have been philosophical.
Not just that they don't want to read it, but that they actually don't understand what's going on unless
yeah.
you put it in this form.
It could absolutely not have been philosophy. Now, it could have been, though, the way I just talked.
Right.
It could have been, you know, I wanted a certain thing because of my clinical training. The patient didn't want that thing because that person didn't see what I was saying about my clinical suggestion. None of those words would be not understood by a clinician, because here we have them and they're nodding their head understanding it. So there were many ways in which we could have talked. Here's one way we couldn't have talked. Philosophical speak. We couldn't have done that. That's true. Would have left out a whole bunch of you know, audience. But we could have done it in a way that didn't, that had all this medical jargon or fact pattern stripped out of it. But then it might have had a harder climb to get the attention early on of clinicians who spoke like this. Okay. Let's talk another first point that Mir gave us about objectivity. What is the connection of this genre to objectivity? Is this... This is... What do you want to say? I think that this is part of the story.
To have objectivity?
Right.
Is it sort of an understanding that if you're reading this, you're supposed to see it as objective?
Okay. So, go ahead.
There's this omniscient narrator here, and obviously the point of view is from the clinician's perspective, but that's not necessarily, you know... It's sort of presented as if that is the view of the scene near the bedchamber
right.
of this person.
It's very much giving us the tone that this is the way it was. This has a certain level of fact and truth embedded in it. The same way that we understand a journal, a piece in the New England Journal that describes a case as, here are the medical facts. So if you talk this way about ethics, you elevate the ethics to the level of medical fact. So it gives you this claim that the entire thing through and through has a kind of objectivity. Again, I'm not accusing anybody of conniving. I'm saying that we want to uncover what is embedded in the genre. And one of the things that's embedded is this looks objective. And what I said, my little narrative of, well, I wanted this because this was my clinical judgment and the person disagreed and this is why I thought the person should do this, doesn't have the same level of lofty objectivity that this does. So genres already convey how serious are they, how fact pattern based are they, how much opinion is there, how much subjectivity. And this particular genre doesn't lend itself to, oh, that's your opinion. It doesn't. It lends itself to anyone would have seen it this way.
But I would say almost it has the patina of objectivity without actually being objective, but maybe I'm getting ahead.
No, that's the point. And then let's take this idea of avoiding culpability or liability. The way that if this is written in a way of objectivity, it's taken the subjective out, where the subjective is the place where you could have done something wrong, or you could have failed to do something that you might have done, or you might have fallen short. Those are all things that aren't possible in an objective situation. You can't navel gaze and say, gosh, was that my opinion, or maybe I should have done it differently, or maybe I am responsible. Those kind of questions are very important. But they don't. This genre doesn't lend itself, doesn't invite those kind of questions. And that's part of the genre too, Shelley.
So some of these things are fact-based, and then they're like you're bumping into the table. So until you get to the resident explained to the patient, no, after that when the patient was upset. So some of the stuff is straight fact. I mean, that could be replicated, right? So that's, I think, that really piece would be factual, and you could prove those. I think what it doesn't have is emotion.
Okay, we'll talk about that as soon as we get to these.
Yeah. There's about two sentences of emotion.
Yeah, and as soon as we get to these in another minute, we're going to go through all of this and going to amplify your point. The only thing I want to question a little bit here was whether it's absolutely the case that by our understanding of medical fact, there are medical facts in here that I think we would not want to dispute. For example, how his hemoglobin was raised. I think we're just going to grant that's just how much his hemoglobin got raised. But I do want us, in case analysis, especially as we move casuistically now to the looking of this case and trying to expand our moral lens, I want you to look very carefully at the way in which this is constructed, even in the part that's about fact. For example, the patient agreed to get blood transfusions. Could that have been said a different way? It could have been. So even the language that's lacing together what I think are, shall we put it, replicable facts are already setting us up for a certain kind of picture of how this patient conducted himself and what his responsibility is for the outcome. All right, I want to move us now that we've thought about genre to the elements, and we're going to look at the case, the top part of the case, through the elements of narrative analysis that Todd lays out. We're going to mine the case for the various features that this genre, so his point is all genres can be talked about as having features. Filter, reportability, closure, character, chronotype, gender. Gender I find to be harder. Maybe you'll see it better than I do. But he'll argue that any genre can have an analysis of, well, what's its filter? What's its character? What's its chronotype? But what we want to do now is define those six features and see what do we know in this case? How does this case speak to those features? What do those features reveal about this genre and this case? So let's look at perspective, first of all. What do we know about perspective in terms of of narrative theory? What is in the genre in narrative analysis? What does the question of filter give us? What are we worried about here? If we say, well, what's the filter in this piece? What is another synonym for filter?
Point of view.
Yes, point of view or perspective. Right. It's the lens through which the story is told. Again, I want to make sure I keep emphasizing this because this is not Get Mad at Clinicians Day. This is about all genres and all authors. So when I ask, whose perspective does this come from? That's not a criticism of that particular author. It's a criticism, if anything, of the genre. So now I'm going to ask you, from whose lens, from whose vantage point is this told?
No way to know that, really.
Okay, what's your guess, though?
From the resident's point of view.
We do. Who do you think it is?
We don't.
It's definitely not the patient.
Okay, it's not the patient. Who else is it not?
It's not the nurse.
Probably not the nurse. It's not the family. There isn't any family there. At least if there is, we don't know that there is. All right, so you're right that we don't know which doctor. But we're pretty sure it's a doctor. Right. Okay, so and now what does it mean that a story told by any particular vantage point that would be framed by that vantage point? If, for example, it is a story told by a clinician, what does that mean for what we see here, and what does it mean for what we're not going to be able to see here? And we would be able to ask that story, that question, about any author. So if, for example, this were written by the patient, we would be able to say as well, given that the patient is the storyteller, the filter that is used to filter information would amount to what kind of things being included and what kind of things being excluded. But right now, we happen to have an author who's probably a clinician. So by that analysis, what is filtered in and what is filtered out? And I don't mean by malice. I mean by genre. So give me, what does that filter of the clinician, given the genre that we're in, mean gets included in this case and what is excluded?
All the medical facts are there.
Okay.
There's pieces of why these medical facts are there that give another clinician the ability to see the differential diagnosis that was excluded by X and X information. So you're sort of filtered into the clinical aspects of the case or why medical decisions were made.
Okay. So it's and thereby it has a justificatory tale. It says, make no mistake about it. We did not screw it up medically, right? It's not, and it makes sure, because from the clinical perspective, the first thing a clinician has to ask herself is, did something go wrong medically, right? Was this a malpractice? Was this an error? Was this negligence? And the filter, of course, is going to have to protect that, rightly so, all legitimate. But what's going to be told then is a medical story that says, this guy was a hard stick. That's why we needed the femoral line. Or the central line. That's what sets us up here. It wasn't that we put in a central line, but we hit the wrong thing and bleeding, this is going to set up a certain kind of medical competence here. But it's also going to talk about, this is probably not written from the person's perspective. Well, I'll ask you that, but I guess, maybe I'll hypothesize. When it says here that, the MICU house staff couldn't place a larger IV angiocath peripherally. Who are we talking about? And what are the arguments that make us think that we are not actually having this story authored by the MICU house staff? That line, despite multiple attempts, the MICU house staff couldn't place a larger IV angiocath peripherally. What makes you think it's not the house staff that's writing this? Remember the house staff.
They may have put a reason in there why
they would
access it.
All right. I mean, and one thing is it certainly has this third-party distance, mm-hmm. right? It's the medical house staff. I'm going to give you the hypothesis. I don't want us to run out of time. We have a lot to do tonight. Let me say it like this. If an attending is writing this up, what is the attending? Who are the house staff, for those of you who are clinically trained, informing those who may not be clinically trained? Who are the house staff?
So it may depend.
Okay.
Most commonly, it'll be residents and hospitalists.
Okay, so
the people that stay in an ICU setting, it's the people that stay in-house day and night. And
okay, so when you read this,
frontline providers of that patient.
Okay, so when you read this, do you think that an attending is included in there? Because I don't.
No.
Okay. All right. So the attending is the top of the pecking order, and everyone else down is at some level of learning, though fellows are pretty darn close. So this is probably about residents and medical students, and they're the ones, certainly in the past for sure, there's some experiments ongoing, but usually overnight you don't have an attending. You do at CHOP, but it's a very unusual place. Mostly you have residents and medical students. Now, if an attending is saying, despite multiple attempts, the NICU house staff couldn't place the larger IV angiocath. Now I've said it in a certain tone to bias it, but I do believe that this is true. What is the attending's stance? I believe this is written by an attending.
Well, he's accepted.
He or she
is accepted what he was told by the House staff as truth.
Okay, for one thing, and why not? I mean, they're not going to, right?
But good. He wasn't there, and okay. he or she was not there and does not actually
okay.
know what occurred,
okay.
so it's sort of third person
okay.
and borderline hearsay.
All right, borderline hearsay.
Well, there's a difference between, from a different perspective, your House staff or the people who most commonly place peripheral IVs because they're there. The
right.
front line of the attending may...
Like, not having to do once a year.
For right. 10 years.
Right.
So, in effect, you may be specifying that the most qualified mm-hmm. people who most frequently do this were unable to...
Okay. Certainly...
In actuality, but whatever.
Right. Right. And, right. And certainly there is no hint that those stupid House staff... There's no nasty in it. It's almost like a... Maybe nobody could have done any better... They're learners. If there is, if it's because they are learners that they couldn't do it, well, that's what learners. That's what it means to be a learner. But it could also be the case that nobody could have done any better. They were the most experienced. They couldn't get it placed. So, in other words, there's no censure here. But it is trying to say it was the House staff, and that is an element that doesn't have to be in there. Thinking about what has to be in there and what doesn't have to be in there. Why would you even have to say that? You could simply say, despite multiple attempts. A larger IV AngiCath couldn't be placed peripherally. In other words, I'm trying to make the point here that the author is selecting information to go in here. And while at first glance we could say, no, it all had to be in there, I submit, in the voice of Todd Chambers, it did not have to be in there. The person did not have to talk about the House staff at all. Person could have just said it wasn't able to get placed. So that's a choice, and that's a choice that was made by for a particular reason. And of course, we can't get into somebody else's mind. But the point is that this is all filter. What else is filtered out or in? What? And I don't mean by malice again. I just mean by the vantage point one brings.
There's no time frame.
Okay.
You don't know how this take place over a half an hour, the entire night.
All right. So that could have been in there. Okay, and we'll talk about chronotype in a minute, which is about that time boundary. All right, what else is not in there that could have been?
Why he refused to get...
Okay, that. We have no idea why the patient had the view that he had. Right, what else do we not know?
But
good.
He says that the patient was upset.
Okay, the patient was upset. Let's talk about patient being upset.
Yeah.
What do we know about patient being upset? Now, I don't want you to be the patient. I want you to just tell me, what does it mean when somebody is upset?
Maybe angry.
Could be angry.
Mm-hmm. Yelling.
Could be yelling. Could be difficult.
Could
okay,
be
upset. What?
Afraid.
Could be afraid.
Mm-hmm. Could have clouded judgment.
Clouded judgment.
Mm-hmm.
Could be resentful. Could have accused you of not doing your job. There are lots of things that could have been perceived by the author. But the word that was used was upset. Now, if I say to you two sentences, the patient was upset. The patient was filled with resentment and rage. The patient was upset. The patient was terrified. In other words, I've upped the ante emotionally by my second description in both cases. That could have been in there. The patient was terrified. But instead, the word was, the patient was upset. So now tell me, why would you use the word upset instead of the angry, resentful, enraged, terrified? Why would you use this word? Why would you say upset?
Well, I would think that you're trying to remain somewhat neutral.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. You're trying to take the emotional tenor and go like this. Upset dials it back, dials it down. Now, maybe the patient doesn't, I don't know the patient. Maybe the patient doesn't want you dialing it back. Maybe the patient feels like this. And the word upset dials it down. Again, no culpability, but there's a lot happening in this case.
I'm also trying to look more objective.
If okay.
the patient is upset,
okay.
you're not interpreting how the patient
all right.
feels. You're just saying what
the all right, is. So you could say, And again, you could make different choices, but you
flailed his arms around.
All right.
If he wanted to.
All right. So one of the ways that you may not even be trying to dial it back. You could be just trying to not inflame or not to make it look sanitized or to not make it mired in human drama. There could be reasons, but again, the word that was selected was upset.
Unfortunately, it could be incorrect recording as well. I mean,
Right. So part of filter, this is part of Todd Chambers' point, is that whatever the author, whoever the author is, patient, family, nurse, doctor, doctor one, doctor two, nurse one, not nurse three, it doesn't matter. Whoever that author is going to speak from the filter of that person's own interpretation. So when I look at you and I see you giving me some type of look, I say, sometimes I'll even say, why am I getting that look from you? I'm not sure how to read that. But I also, in my mind, have already thought of what it is that I'm reading. Oh, she's bored. She's angry. She's very hungry. She wishes she weren't here. She's trying to write a book. I can have interpretations, but the problem with my filtering here is that I could be wrong. And maybe you're actually not hungry. In fact, you've got gas because you ate so much. I have no idea, but I filter it through what I've just, through my own insecurity, worldview, history, read, experience. So once again, to make your point, when I say what I say about a particular circumstance, I could also be wrong. So because I'm filtering it through all of my needs, interests, and background. Okay, good. What else about filtering? We'll move on. Go ahead, Robin.
My question in reference to filter, because you used it kind of in a different way too, like in reference to filtering of what perspective, and then also your filter about how you feel.
Both, exactly. It is, so I have a filter of my values so that when the world comes this way, not just my values, but my history, again, my needs, my insecurities. Let's say that Autumn's read is, I'm a dull teacher. Let's say that's my read on myself. Then when I see facial expressions, I don't think, you pulled an all-nighter, that's why you're tired. Like I have this somebody who's always sleeping in my class. I could then say, he's sleeping because I am boring. That would be one of the ways that I could filter. As it turns out, regardless of your view, I actually don't think I'm a dull teacher. So when you fall asleep in my class, I actually don't think it's because Autumn is dull. That's not my filter. My filter could be other things. My filter could be, you've had a long night in the OR, or, you know, you were flipping channels and surfing the web too much. But regardless, so that is the way that my own estimation, or for example, Autumn believes of herself that she swears too much, so and is not careful with polite decorum language. So if I use a four-letter word in here, and I look out and I see people giving me kind of a look, I say through my own filter, they disapprove of the language I'm using. I don't know whether it's true or not, but that's your second sense of filter. Your first sense is that by nature, I'm going to decide, as we all do as authors, what is important and what is not important. I'm just going to see the world in a certain way. And you're right, filter works in both of those ways here. And we're seeing it very evident here. Certain things are being couched in certain ways. Certain information is being left out. There are certain kinds of views, for example, that the house staff did the best they could, that we can actually get and glean from this very simple case. Any more questions on filter? All right, so knowing now that there's going to be a particular filter from a single author vantage point or a single perspective vantage point, we can already imagine there's a whole bunch of stuff that wouldn't get included by other authors. Good. What about reportability? Reportability turns out to be quite important in clinical ethics. Not so much maybe some in, to a certain extent in this case, but I think even more importantly, or at least as importantly, in what kind of circumstances become cases at all. Tell me about reportability. What is reportability in genre? And then more specifically, what is reportability in this genre?
Is it the question we asked in the beginning, why is this a bioethics case?
Yes, it has to have some reason why it came to how it came to be a clinical ethics case. There had to be something that made it a case. And every genre has constraints around what makes it reportable. Just like when I gave my little instance of Autumn got in the car, drove down 95, and got home safely. Did not qualify for reportability in a murder mystery. What gets reportability? What reaches that bar in a murder mystery? Well, if it's a murder mystery, somebody had to have been killed. So that's what makes it reportable. And if you don't have that, it's not reportable in that genre. What makes something reportable as a clinical ethics case? What makes it a clinical ethics case? What's the reportability factor?
Something occurs outside of the norm.
Okay, it has to occur outside of the norm. Good, that's one element of it. It's a break in the action somehow. And what of what variety of break in the action out of the norm?
Usually a negative.
Okay, it's got to have a negative. Right, so for example, if here's a break in the norm. I come to your unit and I bring you flowers for how wonderful you've taken care of me. That's a break in the norm, but it doesn't qualify as a clinical ethics case. So it's got to be a kind of negative, and then there's another element to it.
Like you have to have an opinion, like you have to right. take away an opinion once you've read it.
It's got
to
have a controversy somehow. It's got to be a dilemma. In fact, I want us to take a few minutes now and think about where, in the arena of healthcare delivery, there could be ethical considerations, ethical concerns, ethical critique that would not rise to the level of reportability that would make it an ethics case, a clinical ethics case. Can you think about ethical difficulties, ethical misfires, ethical impermissibilities, or ethical affronts or insults that would not constitute a clinical ethics case? Can you give me some instances where there'd be an ethical concern, worry, criticism, but it doesn't rise. Good.
Isn't there a lot of debate with like CPR?
Say it again.
CPR. Okay. There's a lot of cases with that because I think you're required to perform. It's the only like procedure you can do without consent.
Okay.
But people still bring it up, like whether that should be the case, kind of thing.
Okay. Let me see if I can understand what you're saying in terms of reportability. Are you saying that
bring up CPR now to ethics committees very often? Like,
okay, all right. So there could be standing. That's good. All right, I like that. Very different vein from where I was going, but I like that. I think what you're saying is important. What you're saying is a standing practice in the world that, let's say, in the world of American healthcare, that's just what we do. That's what we do. Even if there's critique about that very practice, it doesn't rise to the level of ethics consult case, even though somebody might be a little bit worried about it ethically. But because it's considered just the way that we do it, the standard of care, the received view, it doesn't make it onto the clinical ethics case at the committee. Okay, good. Tell me some more about, give me another example where somebody might feel ethically wronged in a healthcare circumstance, but it would not rise to the level of a clinical ethics case.
Discussing a patient case in an elevator.
Okay, right. So some kind of HIPAA violation would not rise to it unless it was heard by somebody. I'm going to pass out a piece. It's coming out in AJOB in May, called "The Difficult Patient Reconceived." I've put "difficult" in scare quotes, so don't get mad, because I don't actually think that patients are difficult. And I want you to turn to either page 3 or 4, where I have embedded in this piece, and we're not going to look at it for more than a second. You can take it and read or throw it out, whatever you're going to do. But what I want to do is illustrate instances of patients that clinicians might deem difficult. Now, I know many clinicians would never call any patient difficult. Fine. But clinicians who would deem a patient difficult, I have two scenarios in there, Susan and Fred. Fred, for example, in the Fred example, he's a young man with a terrible injury, and he's angry, and he feels resentment at the way that he's treated, and he feels like he's being seen as a criminal because of his race and because of his age and because of his past truancy and his history of drug abuse, and he feels that he is being badly treated by the staff. That's the case of Fred. That will not rise to the level of an ethics consult, even though Fred feels ethically assaulted every single day by the glares he gets. Again, this is his filter, but by what he perceives as a condescension, as racism, as bias of class, of stereotype for how this happened. That will not get to an ethics committee, even though all the words I just use are ethically wholly fraught. Fred feels ethically assaulted, and nevertheless, it will not rise. Why will it not rise? Because it doesn't have an ethical controversy at its core. Clinical ethics cases become reportable when there's a controversy, not just because somebody feels ethically maltreated. Or if you think about the movie, you have to reach far back to the movie The Doctor with William Hurt. At one point, this woman who's middle age has open heart surgery, and she has a very large scar, and she says to her clinician, "I feel very embarrassed about that scar." And he says to her, because she says there's staple marks, and you know, and the scar itself. And he says, "I don't know why, you're just like a centerfold, staples and all." And she's, of course, mortified and humiliated by this and devastated. Obviously, a statement that is hurtful and wrong, but it's not going to rise to the level of a clinical ethics consult. So, point, when we talk about reportability, there are constraints around the practice of clinical ethics that decide what cases get looked at as cases and what kind of ethical issues that I think you will now agree are ethically problematic that don't rise to the level of clinical ethics case because they don't have the constraints of report. They don't rise to the bar of what in this field is understood as reportability. Now, I'm trying to change that. That's why this paper is called an expanded moral mandate for clinical ethics consultation, because I'm trying to argue this very point that these cases really do need ethical attention even though they don't rise. And I even use this term reportability, which is why I borrow it and cite Todd for it. All right, let me ask you one more question before we move past reportability. Can you think of a case that would have been ethically controversial, would have met the bar of reportability in the past in the United States, but would not reach the bar of reportability today? Can you think of something that would have been understood as a clinical ethics case 30 years ago, but would not be understood today?
Therapeutic abortion, would that
fit? All right. Okay, good. Mrs. Jones has come to the hospital begging to have a therapeutic abortion because she's had 5 children and cannot afford her 6th. That would be a case that is now not a case. Okay, what else? How about this? Mr. Jones insists on being with his wife when she goes to the delivery room to have her child. Oh. That would have been a case. My father wasn't in the delivery room. And if my father had insisted that it was his right, which is an ethical language, to be in that delivery room, that would have been a break in the action. Because, you know, you've seen all the movies. The husbands or the partners, they paced back and forth. And then after everything was all cleaned up and then everything, then the husband came in, the thing, right? Okay, exactly. Exactly. All right, or what about this? Competent patient, lucid and clear in her wishes, would like her ventilator removed. What's the issue here? That would have been a case. 25 years pre-Cruzan, pre-Quinlan, absolutely. Okay, so reportability is also culturally situated and temporally situated. All right, let's go on. The others are we get through much quicker. Let's talk about closure. When a closure is, I'm just going to define it for you, when the case ends. And you might think, well, the end of the story is the end of the story, as if there could really only be one end of the story. But actually, there are real choices made in the practice of clinical ethics about when the story ends. When does the story end in American clinical ethics?
Leaves
the hospital would be an end?
Or not.
Or dead? Good. Regardless, when they leave, it's over. That's right. That's one ending. What else?
Is it when they're dead? I mean, wouldn't a clinical consult, if something still went amiss or went off the rails? Isn't this a clinical consult and the patient's dead?
Well, but the end of the story is already written. I don't mean when would we talk about it. I mean when. What's closure in the story? So in other words, it doesn't say. It's a good point, so let me clarify. I'm not talking about when does the practice of ethics reflection end. I'm asking, in the genre of the write-up, how do we understand the parameters of the story? And the story says he could not be resuscitated due to a large ongoing GI hemorrhage. How could the story be extended? Let's make the point the other way. You're right about closure. Closure in a clinical ethics case is when it's been decided, when there was some resolution that was described, or when somebody dies, or when somebody leaves. These are kind of the big moments of closure. But tell me how this story could have been written to have a different ending if the genre of clinical ethics cases, case write-up, was different? Well, what could be there? Could be tacked on there.
Recommendations? Or you could say...
All right. Like what? What kind of recommendation? I'll give you one. Given the profound nature... Here, I'm imagining that I'm writing this, so... No, I understand. So imagine that I've continued on in the italics. So this is italics. Given the tragedy of this case, we implemented sessions for informed consent and gathering of patient story there forward. We have in-services now planned quarterly to bring in facilitation techniques. We now have, right, it could go on. I don't know how it would go on, but it could go on, but it doesn't. The genre is that this is the end of the action. And if that were in that case, it be like, wow, weird. I mean, and so closure is understood in certain parameters. Now, let's imagine that we have a little bit of a different case here. We have, let's say, family members surrounding the loved one. Tell me why closing off the clinical ethics case with could not be resuscitated, large ongoing hemorrhage, fails to perceive ethical issues still ongoing. Imagine that his mom or girlfriend or boyfriend or child were at the bedside. The case would still end the same way because that's the genre. But tell me what kind of ethical issues would still be there, or even if they're not there, because you know, even if the people aren't at the bedside, but I'm just trying to give you a way of prompting you to think about why is this manner of closing off the story shortchanging all the ethics and the ethical issues that might be around this case? And that's just one way that we're cutting it off. Let me say it again. Let me say it a different way. What ethical considerations might still be at play? What ethical harms, what ethical concerns, what ethical analyses might still be swirling even though the patient is dead?
The effect on the other clinician.
Okay, let's talk about that. Here's what you don't hear. Do you think that the person who tried her best to get this patient to take a central line feels that, well, he couldn't be resuscitated due to the large GI hemorrhage, you know? Hey, want to get a beer afterwards? I mean, I'm kind of thirsty. Hey, oh, you know Grey's Anatomy's on tonight. Is that really what happened to that clinician? What happened to that clinician?
Devastated.
Devastated, right? This person had a salvageable patient. This patient could have lived with the central line. Put yourself in the resident's position of having lost someone, having someone died on his or her service that could easily have been salvaged. Whether you think you had any culpability in it or not, you are racked. You can't help it. You're a human being and you are in moral distress. But where's the moral distress of the nurse or the resident that witnessed this? So when we think about how closure in a clinical ethics case defines the case, that's the kind of analysis Todd Chambers wants you to be thinking about. You think that there isn't a moral distress and assault on the part of the people who witnessed this, whether they were the loved ones or whether they were the providers of various stripes. I do a lot of residency stuff with both Hupp and Pensy Radiology. And I had a woman who asked to talk to me after one session about when she was an intern, because radiologists go through a year of medicine internship before they go to radiology. It was a whole year later, and she presided over a withdrawal kind of case. Not quite this case, but a different kind of case. She was still so morally burdened. I talked to her for an hour of debrief and processing about how overwhelmed she was morally with what had taken place, and no culpability, no responsibility. It was not her fault. It wasn't guilt. My point is that when you cut a case off like this, you define what's morally important and what's morally not important. But our discussion of the clinician's emotional, whether a nurse or physician, their emotional burden that they take after the case, that's ethics too. And it's not in this case because the genre has already decided they're part of the periphery in the case. So that's part of closure and why it matters. Okay, let's talk about character. Character is the psychological dimension of the players. And I'm going to add to that the conception of the good. I think we've used that term as an umbrella for all of the various values and priorities and beliefs and commitments that an individual has. Add on to that one's the psychological dimensions or aspects of the patient, and that includes their virtues and their vices. What do we know about the character of any of the participants in this act, in this play? What do we know?
Nothing.
And that's an action itself. In other words, the way that this genre is written does not illuminate, does not allow us to have the character of any participant illuminated. We don't know anything about anyone in terms of what the core beliefs were, commitments, virtues, vices. We know nothing of it. Well, how could it be different? Well, let's imagine that we could use an adjective. The patient was a people pleaser. The patient was resolute. The patient was belligerent. The patient was quick to anger. The patient was very sad. The patient was terrified. Any of those would shine quite a different light on this case. Or what about the clinicians were begging? The clinicians were distraught. The clinicians were abrasive. The clinicians were condescending. The clinicians were empathic, or the clinician. Any one of those, again, shines very different light. Now, of course, if it's the author who's the clinician involved saying, and the clinician was so empathic, you wouldn't have believed it. Of course, I know that that's a problem. But what I mean, if this genre allowed the emotional depiction and the vices and the virtues of the various participants, was able to flesh out more of the character and the disposition of the players, this would look very, very different. For example, how does this case look to you if I tell you the clinicians were so empathic? Then you're like, wow, I wonder what went wrong. I mean, they were so empathic and sensitive and caring. That's very different from what you think if I say they were rushed, they were abrasive, they were condescending, they were infantilizing. Now you're looking at this scenario very differently. So to be without character in a story is to actually be missing quite a bit. And this genre disarms us. Okay. And finally, gender's a little bit puzzling. I'm going to leave that because this is the idea that is it linear? Is it plot-driven? I think there might be something there, but that's what gender is. I'm going to do chronotype, and then I want to move on to reading the bottom half of the case for the last few minutes. Let's look at setting. Chronotype is the setting. It's the place where it takes place. How could the way in which the story is told differ if the chronotype were different, if the setting were different? How does the space and time and timing, how does that influence this genre and the way that clinical ethics cases are written? You've already talked about how we get no sense of time. We can't orient ourselves into how long a space we've got. All right, how else does the setting influence what we say and what we leave out and what we put in to this story? How does the setting that we're in?
Well, we can change your thoughts on all the people involved if you're in a small 5-bed NICU with 3 health staff versus a 60-bed unit with 2 fellows.
All right. Great.
It gives you a sense of
knowledge. Let's imagine, for example, that the number of patients, the number of providers, nurses and physicians who walked into that room during this entire time was 10. That's a very different way of understanding than when one nurse was assigned to this patient and one physician. I don't know how the outcome would have changed, but you can see that we'd have many, many, many more actors doing many more things. And even though 1 or 2 or 3 or 90% might have been one way, empathic, 10% might have been abrasive, or vice versa. And that actually would tell us quite a bit about how this story. Or, for example, if I felt like someone had me in the palm of their hand, so to speak, for the entire night, that would feel a lot different than if I felt that I was on an assembly line and people were coming in, coming out, and nobody really cared, and I was just another, chart on the way. So setting is actually going to matter. Even if every one of those people was fully empathic, having that many people could influence the way I feel cared about, even if in the heart of hearts of those providers, I actually was really cared for. So chronotype is going to matter too.
So that's the same as, like, you start this story as this patient was day 123 in this hospital
right.
stay versus it was the first 12 hours that they
exactly.
had. Changes the whole
exactly right.
perspective.
Exactly. Good. Alrighty. So, now that we have all of this teased out here about the elements, what we want to be thinking about is, how do the elements that are part of the convention of the clinical ethic genre affect what we can see ethically and what we can't see ethically? What kind of ethical analysis are we empowered to have? And what type of ethical analysis could we not possibly have? Because we couldn't see the ethical elements. And again, this is tying back to casuistry and forward to the next time we meet. Given that this is the case you have in front of you, what kind of ethical analysis can you bring to bear? What kind of things can you see? And what kind of things can you not see? Let me hear what you have to say on that, Pat. What kind of things can you say? What kind of analysis can you bring to bear? And what isn't even possible to say?
I think nobody makes a special effort to bring somebody besides the attendants to convince him that was necessary.
All right. So one of the things we cannot answer is how much effort and of what type of effort was brought to bear to find a different, to have the patient have a change of heart. We can't see in here whether enough effort was expended. Because we have no evidence that there was a lot of effort or that there was no effort. We can't see it. What else?
I think the word too is that despite multiple attempts,
Okay. All right. So one thing we could ask is, and let's think about despite multiple attempts. Despite multiple attempts lets us say the clinicians tried as hard as they could. But what it doesn't enable us to say is, what did it feel like to the patient to be on the receiving end of multiple attempts? We can't figure out from this what it would be like to be the person who had to be the victim of multiple attempts. You see how I changed the tone there. One hand, it's to say, despite multiple attempts, it just couldn't be done, is a very different way of saying from this. Multiple attempts were tried, and the patient was on the receiving end of multiple interventions, multiple sticks, multiple failed IV sticks. Those two things are quite different. One emphasizes that everything was done that could be done, and the other means that when you are on the receiving end of having a procedure repeated over and over again, perhaps because your body's just not cooperating or because of the lack of or the level of training on the part of the clinicians, either way, we have a very different thing that we could say here about the ethical considerations at play. Okay, what else?
You also don't know if it was the latter and the patient is feeling frustrated, you have no idea if the clinician is aware that the patient is feeling.
Right. How sensitive are the clinicians? We can't say. That's right. So, for example, if what we cannot, and let me say that in a larger frame, what we cannot say, what we cannot do, is a virtue ethics analysis. We can only look at questions like, was there any malpractice? And it looks like no, there wasn't. Was the person informed? Well, to a certain extent, it seems that the person was. Now, we're going to talk next time we meet, about what's the extent of that. So we can say, was a consent process done? Yes, there was a consent process done. Did the patient have the autonomy to deny consent? Yes, the patient was offered the opportunity to accept, to give consent, or to refuse consent. These are the ethical things we can say about the case. What we want to do is think about all the things we can't say. And one of the things we can't say is, what were the various characterological, dispositional traits of virtue and vice displayed by all the parties? Do we have the ideal doctor? Do we have the ideal patient? Do we have the is there some vice that was exhibited by any of the various parties that we might be able to give a critical analysis of? Or virtues, on the other hand. These are all things that could not be said. All right. any other things that we want to say about this top part that has not been said? Any other things that you're gleaning from here? What do you get from this in terms of what the patient did, what the doctor did, who's at fault? Anything?
It's not quite that. It might be a very cynical take. It seems like the case write-up was almost geared to answer the questions, the very narrow questions of, was there informed consent? Was there malpractice? Was there autonomy? So it almost as if presages those, you know, those are the things I should be worried about, and I've now written up the case. Not again, not in a malicious way, but since those are the questions one is worried about, I've given you the facts that would answer those questions.
And actually, I don't think it's cynical because I don't think it's pejorative. I'm going to argue next time we meet in that paper, Why the Clinical Ethics We Fails Patients, that bioethics as a practice in the United States has laid out for us the 10 considerations we most have to think about. And so when we write up cases, we write them around those particular kinds of concerns. Was there informed consent? Was there truth-telling? Confidentiality? Was there autonomy? Was there paternalism? We have a constrained set, which I would like us to expand, and many of us are on that sort of same bandwagon, but it would not be an accident, if that hypothesis is right, that there are certain things we tick off to say, this has been done right, or this has not been done right. And that's a fairly narrow lens. But what we can't do, and it isn't cynical, and it's not cynical for this reason. If I hand you 5 tools, and you use 5 tools, I can't say, you only used 5 tools. Wait, I only gave you 5 tools. Part of the problem of bioethics is that we have given a certain set of tools. We have created a certain kind of genre. And it's not going to be a surprise then that this is what we see and this is what we are blind to. So let's take our last minute and read the bottom, and then we'll adjourn and you'll mull it over and we'll see each other afterwards. So, Robin, why don't you give us a read here at the bottom?
From the very beginning, his experience in the hospital.
Yeah.
His experience in the hospital has been horrible, from the long wait in the ER to the
barrage
of invasive tests to the admission to the ICU. He's been passed from doctor to doctor, and no one seems to know what they're doing or be in charge. He feels like he's being used as a guinea pig for the training of the new doctors. He feels indignation and resentment at the failed attempts to insert the large catheters. If they had given him a real doctor...
And not these amateurs.
Okay.
Sorry.
If they had given him a real doctor and these amateurs...
I'm sorry.
This wouldn't have happened. The repeated failed attempts by the house staff have made him lose all confidence in the team and undermine his trust, in the treating residents. He feels powerless and helpless. He feels out of control. This should be happening to someone. This should not be happening to someone 30 years old. He feels betrayed by his own young body. He's very scared.
Okay. So obviously, what I've done here is, I can't be in the mind of a man who's dead, and I'm not a man, and I didn't have this happen. But it's an attempt to try a different perspective. And what we'll do, we're going to adjourn now, but what we want to do is think about, if that was the case, and we didn't have the top part, how would our analysis be different? And we won't do that now. We'll table that. But what we want to do is think, if that were the way that clinical ethics cases got written by the various parties and stakeholders, how would that change clinical ethics? Alrighty.